Hey, y'all, how's it going? Welcome to the show. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Hey, guess what? Today on the show, we're going to be talking about the Iran nuclear deal. I know. You're shocked and surprised and not bored. Rhys Ehrlich is going to be on the show. Hey, guess what? He just got back from Iran, where he was doing journalism. I'm glad they didn't lock him up. Apparently, they like to lock up American journalists from time to time. Can't say I approve of that. Anyway, Rhys made it back, and he's going to tell us some things. It's going to be great. And then also, every day on the show, you hear me talk about WallStreetWindow.com. It's my friend Mike Swanson. He's the author of the book, The War State, which you can also get on audiobook. And it's great. It's a history of the military-industrial complex from the end of World War II on, basically through Kennedy. So first three presidents there, post-war, and the rise of the new right, basically. And so, yeah, man, and I don't mean the Russell Kirk and the writers. I mean the freaking power. I mean McDonnell. I mean right-wingers on welfare making weapons. That's what I mean. Anyway, great stuff there. And then, also he does Wall Street Window. And Wall Street Window is where he gives investment advice, because he's a former hedge fund manager who made a killing understanding Austrian school economics and applying his Austrian schoolings to the ways of the market. And just like with everything on this show, I can say with a straight face, no problem, you've been hearing for many, many months now commercials for WallStreetWindow.com that say, yeah, man, you ought to take this guy's advice and get the hell out of the market. The stock market right now is in a giant bubble. In fact, I even made a bumper sticker like that. Get out of the stock market. It's a giant fake bubble again, is what the bumper sticker says. Yeah, I'm trying to help people out, man. It's altruism. $2.95, libertystickers.com. $2.95 in depreciating American dollars. Anyway, so Mike, he's been saying, hey, look out, it's a big fake bubble. And now the big fake bubble's popped again, so we're going to hear from him about, I don't know, what happened. And I think, you know, we're going to assume for the sake of the argument that you have a little bit of money and maybe could use some good advice about what to do with it. Or I think he'll probably only talk about in terms of what he's doing. But see, that's the whole great gimmick about Wall Street Window. I mean, it's not a gimmick. That's a negative term. But I think that's what's great about it, is he just updates everybody about everything that he does in his own account. So that's his advice. Here's what I'm doing, and here's why I'm doing it. Agree with me or not, there goes my money. I'm betting it on red. And so that's why I say in the commercials, either follow, you know, you can follow along on paper for a while and see if he's right before you get into the game. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, well, anyway, so he's going to be here to talk about what the hell is going on, why it crashed, and what to do. Where we are. Maybe I can ask him about the Chinese housing market, construction market, that I think the bottom hasn't fallen out of it yet. That was the one where David Stockman said, oh man, just, you know, bend over and kiss your ass goodbye. We're done. The whole world economy is going to collapse when the Chinese mortgage-backed securities market, for lack of a better term, when that gigantic bubble of debt and inflation collapses. Oh boy. Bet against it. I don't know what kind of time frame, but bet against it. I know that. All right, so Mike Swanson, he's going to be on here. Talk about that. So that's the guests for today, unless other people answer back. I'm still trying to get the people from the LA Times about the escalation in Yemen story, and I'm still trying to get Jonathan Marshall about the coup in Honduras and all the aftermath of that. He wrote a recent piece for consortiumnews.com about it. That's really good. And then also Andrew Coburn has a new piece at Harper's about Ukraine, which actually I'm happy he didn't answer back because I didn't finish reading the article now that I think about it. But yeah, good old Andrew Coburn, man. That's Patrick Coburn's brother, of course. And then, Mitch Prothero. You know what? Even though I don't have him on the show here today, I think we're going to have to talk about his article anyway. Boy, I just never got all this organized in time today. Syrian rebels. Turkey. Tipped Al-Qaeda group to U.S. trained fighters. Al-Qaeda in Syria being the al-Nusra front. And remember, the Pentagon had trained this group with Division 30, wasn't it called? Is that like Operation 40? Just Division 30? Yeah, it's kind of another Bay of Pigs sort of a thing. It's America's speciality. You and him go fight. I promise, I'll back you up. Go ahead. Anyway, so America, the DOD in Turkey trained up moderate Syrians, whatever moderate means. It means they're willing to shut up about Mohammed for a few weeks while they get paid and armed and fed for a little while by the CIA, or by, in this case, the soldiers. I guess Army Rangers. But anyway, so they sent them into Turkey, and then, as you know, they were captured. 54 of them were captured, a few killed, their leaders captured, the rest scattered. And then now Mitch Prothero says the Turks sold the Americans out. The Turks prefer the al-Nusra front. And they were worried that this group would end up, I don't know, supposedly fighting al-Nusra instead of ISIS. I guess that's possible. Maybe they didn't really realize how badly, or maybe, you know, it's only some factions in America. I'm not sure who in the CIA or the DOD or inside the establishment are all pushing this idea about rebranding al-Nusra and calling them the moderates now. They even ran a cover story. I know, I almost don't believe it, but no, really, they ran a cover story in Foreign Affairs. The most prestigious establishment foreign policy journal in America, of the Council on Foreign Relations, cover story, and for good measure, they went ahead and put Osama and Zawahiri on the cover, you know, or like gave them a big glossy freaking thing. On the web version, anyway, the PDF file came with a big picture of Osama and Zawahiri, just so there's, you know, they're not even trying to say, oh, no, but al-Nusra is really very different than those guys. They have to concede they're not. They are. They're still loyal to Zawahiri. They're loyal to al-Qaeda, the organization, still. And anyway, so, you know, I don't know, man, if that's really what their problem was or not. The Turks. I mean, maybe their problem was that these guys don't mean to, or, you know, are being hired to fight the Islamic State and not Assad. And that's what they still want to focus on, is getting rid of Assad. And it seems like they don't even, I don't know, they kind of have a policy which is just muddle through, but what a disaster. So, you know, the U.S. now is flying planes out of Turkey to bomb the Islamic State. And Prothero, he has quotes here from these guys saying that Nusra and the Islamic State are the same damn thing, man. The only thing that they're fighting about is leadership. Who's the boss and who's following whose orders? That's it. That the leaders of al-Nusra are formerly with the Islamic State. Yeah, that's right. It's the same thing. Al-Qaeda in Iraq, the Islamic State. That's what it is. They renamed it the Islamic State in Iraq back in 2006. Anyway, they are the exact same thing there. And, you know, I don't know. I wonder if the CIA worked with the Turks to stab the DOD in the back on this one. You think there's a big fight between Langley and the Pentagon on this today? This week?
Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code SCOTT when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com.
Hey, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. Hey, you know how that clip of Madeleine Albright saying that, well, it's a hard choice, but we think the price is worth it for suffocating and strangling and starving 500,000 helpless Iraqi children to death for a policy of driving Saddam Hussein out of power, right? Because that makes total sense, right? Just like in Cuba, once we reduce the civilian population to laying down and dying, with nothing to eat, then they'll rise up and overthrow the government because they'll blame him, not us, and because they'll be so newly empowered in their starving state. Don't you get it? I mean, okay, it sounds a little bit contradictory on the face of it, but no, really. The price is worth it. And yes, and the price including, yeah, September 11th and a whole new generation of endless war since then, too. Yeah, The price is worth it. And I know what you're saying, but Madeleine Albright has apologized for saying that so many times. Yeah, I know, but you know what? Still to this day, no one has said to her, yeah, I know you apologize for saying that. But do you apologize for the sanctions, or do you in fact think the price was worth it? What are we talking about here, hurt feelings or dead bodies? Americans are so stupid. Oh, the thing that the person said is offensive. She murdered 500,000 babies. Which thing is the important thing for her to apologize about? Gee, I don't know. Let me meditate for a week and concentrate real hard and see if I can figure out which is the more offensive problem there that needs to be grown. Anyway, point is, guess what? My friend Jeremy, he cleaned up that clip. You know, it always sounds terrible. It's always full of static and hum and everything. Check it out.
We have heard that 500,000 children have died. I mean, that's more children than died in Hiroshima. You know, is the price worth it?
I think this is a very hard choice, but we think the price is worth it.
Isn't that great? And yes, it does still have quite a bit of hum there, I recognize, but still, compared to how much he got out of it, great. And all the crackles gone and all that, too. Anyway, it's tough to find a good version of that clip, man. If somebody has a better version, let me know. There's a humless version of that thing. Anyway, so that's pretty cool. All right, many things to talk about. The France train thing. So the guy's saying, I'm not a jihadist, I'm just a thief. I wasn't going to kill everybody, I was just going to try to rob them. Okay. And they're saying, yeah, but he went to Syria. Well, maybe he did, maybe he didn't, but even if he did, I guess that doesn't necessarily mean that he worked in Obama's jihadist army there. Although it would be fitting. Something I've been warning about for years and years before it started. Of course, there was the attack in Brussels and the attack in Paris, both of which were by veterans of the Syrian jihad. And there's sure to be more of that coming. Well, that's what happens when the U.S. and French and British and Italian and allied governments support the suicide bomber jihadist types. They get them. Reap them, sow them, that kind of thing. So I don't know. Maybe it was just a bum, and people just jumped to conclusions. I mean, I think the cop said, man, the guy is dressed in rags, thin as a rail, clearly malnourished, and, you know, I don't know if he was a drug addict or what, but all right. Still, those guys did the right thing, beating the crap out of him and preventing him from holding his gun to anybody's head, whether he really meant to kill anybody or not. So that's good, at least. All right, now I got to talk about Rand Paul failing for a minute. You know, he put out a thing. He wants to make the Fed more effective. I swear to you, man. I mean, or maybe I shouldn't swear to you because I guess, you know, I don't know. But yeah, I mean, it seems like I'm reading over here at Target Liberty. Here at libertyfight.com. Yeah, look, there it is. It's in the tweet. The goals of the audit are constructive and clear: to improve transparency and ultimately make the Fed more effective. He wrote an entire article about auditing the Fed that does not mention the boom and bust business cycle at all. I mean, he goes after corruption and crony capitalism and bailouts and that kind of thing, but that's what the Fed is. Ask Ron. He'll tell you it's a bailout all day, every day. That's what the Fed is, the lender of last resort. It means that they will create money to keep banks whole when they make bad bets all day, every day, which at the very least is subsidizing them into getting really close to the line and making a lot of bad loans that they otherwise wouldn't make and that kind of thing. And anyway, Rand wants to make the Fed more effective. He can't take any single thing and just be good on it. Every single issue, even on the Fed. And now saying audit the Fed, okay, that's a pale in comparison, or yeah, that pales in comparison to abolishing it. But at least it's not contrary to abolishing it. But making it more effective, is. So I can understand maybe he didn't want to go as far as end the Fed. Although, why not? Really think we're better off with it? Or no, just, people are afraid to hear that message yet. Yeah, so what good is it doing you being just another Huckabee up there? Seriously, how is Rand Paul, and you know what, I don't know, man. I guess my problem is that, just like the people who believe in him, my problem is that I believe in the secret Rand Paul too. Somewhere in there, he's got to know that his father is the one who's good on everything and right on everything, and that he must have to secretly agree with his father, whose thought is superior on all of this stuff. But he just has made this compromise and just thinks that the more conservative, the more run-of-the-mill he gets, the more acceptable he'll be, the greater candidate for president he'll be. But I just can't, The problem is that's not true. The problem is he is a Reagan conservative. The problem is there isn't a secret Rand Paul at all. He really is this bad on stuff. And that's why he won't snap out of it and understand. It's not just me saying this. You know, Tom Woods agrees with me on this, and a lot of other people said the same thing too, about how, you know, if he would run as his dad, or, you know, more or less adopt his father's positions, radical opposition to the status quo, then he would do great. People would love him. And right now, the only person who's saying, the whole damn system is wrong, is Donald Trump, who wants to create a fascist dictatorship in the place of our participatory democratic fascist system that we have now. And there's nobody up there saying, no, we don't need leaders, we need liberty. Liberty is what works. We don't need a giant border wall. We don't need economic protection. We don't need war in the Middle East. We just need peace and freedom. Oh, no, Republicans don't agree with that. Yeah, well, out-argue them and win them over, man. Or just go back to being an eye doctor and let the father have the spotlight back. We want Ron back. Enough of this goofball.
Hey, y'all, Scott here for Samurai Tech Academy at MasterSamuraiTech.com. Modern appliance repair requires true technicians who can troubleshoot their high-tech electronics. If you're young and looking to make some real money, or you've been at it a while and just need to keep your skills up to date, Samurai Tech Academy teaches it all. And they'll also show you the business, how to own and run your own. Take a free sample course to see how easily you can learn appliance repair from MasterSamuraiTech.com. Use coupon code Scott Horton for 10% off any course or set of courses at MasterSamuraiTech.com.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com.
Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
Poor Mike Swanson, man. Here during the break, I'm telling him what I really think about Rand. You've probably never heard that many cuss words at one time in life. All right. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton, and our first guest is Mike Swanson. He is the author of The War State, about how Truman, Ike, and JFK all empowered and fought to limit the rise of the national security state. You got to read it. It's really great. And also, he does Wall Street Window, where he gives good investment advice, like for months and months and months now, maybe more than a year, he's been saying, get out of the stock market bubble before it explodes. Welcome back to the show. How you doing, Mike?
Oh, I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing real good. I guess it imploded more than it exploded, but just how bad is it?
Well, I was listening to your discussion about the Federal Reserve and Rand Paul, and I think it's not bad yet, but I think it's going to get bad, and maybe the best way to understand why is what the Fed's doing. and the idea that they can, what was it he said, run things better or something?
Make it more effective. By the way, as long as I'm interrupting, I can hear you good and loud, so I'll ask you to hold the telephone handset away from your mouth because the microphone on your phone is blown and is crackling on us a bit there. But I got you good and loud in the studio, so just kind of hold it away from you a bit. Thanks.
Is that better now?
Oh, yeah, perfect.
Okay, good.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah. But anyway, to understand what's happening, I'll tell a little story. Back in 2008, in January, or at New Year, I traded the markets, and I was in cash. And I knew the market was falling. That was the start of that bear market. But it had gotten very, very oversold. Like, it fell days and days in a row. And normally, it would bounce in such a situation. Like, if you look at historical charts and statistics, and, you know, when something falls that many points that quickly, normally it bounces. And this was a Friday before Martin Luther King Day, and I bought, and I put all my money into a fund that invests in the S&P 500. And I'm thinking to myself, well, the market can bounce. Maybe I'll make 5%. And, the stock market doesn't really drop that much when it does in a single day, so maybe I'm risking 2% or 1% or something. But to make a long story short, it was Martin Luther King weekend, and so the market was closed Monday, but everything overseas crashed about 10%. Sunday, then overnight here, it's Sunday, Monday over there, it was crashing 10%. Then the next day, their market was down 10%, and I looked, and overnight, I woke up like 3 or 4 in the morning, and the Dow was poised to gap down 1,000 points. And I was thinking to myself, well, it's a crash. You know, I'm going to lose half my money, possibly. I never experienced something like that before, thinking, well, I'm going to lose half my money, and this is really the big one, and so forth. And what happened was, before the market up, the stock market opened up the next day, the Federal Reserve lowered interest rates by 75 points. Enforced the stock market back up. So I got out even, or I may have actually made a little bit, I don't really remember, but I didn't lose anything. What happened was the Fed bailed me out, just like you're talking about it bails out banks. It bailed me out that day. And the problem is what they've done over the past couple of years by keeping interest rates at zero, and they created a couple of these so-called quantitative easing programs that bought bonds and tried to put liquidity into the system. They've created another stock market bubble boom, and the valuations got as high for the S&P 500 as they had gotten only two previous times, and that was 2000 and 1929. If you use something called the cyclically adjusted P ratio, which looks at the average price to earnings ratio for 10 years adjusted for inflation. So it's a serious, it became a serious bubble. And the people, if you watch CNBC or the financial media, they would justify this by saying, well, interest rates are zero, so therefore stocks that you can get any dividend for should be worth this price. The economy is good. And they'd also say, look, the Federal Reserve has kind of made it so the stock market won't drop, and they'll, you know, create another quantitative easing program or do whatever to keep it going up. And people bullish on the stock market, and that's basically what they believe and have come to believe. The problem is that I think the market is became unsustainable and starting a bear market. And if that is the case, we're really in a situation where the Federal Reserve cannot do anything, which I don't know if that's ever occurred in the United States.
Wait, actually, you know what? I think your phone kind of messed up a little bit. Where the what can't do anything? Where the Fed itself can't do anything?
Yeah, if the stock market declines now, there's nothing the Federal Reserve can do because interest rates are zero. Mm-hmm. And the past couple months, they've been saying they're going to raise rates, actually, before the end of the year. They were hinting a couple months ago they'd raise rates in September. They're claiming that the economy is growing and it's time to, you know, get off this zero interest rate policy. And interesting enough, Tuesday last week, these Fed minutes came out where they basically said, well, we're not going to raise rates in September. Maybe we'll do it in December. Mm-hmm. Because of China. They said there's signs that the economy may not be growing as fast as they wanted it to grow. And they've been saying, you know, preparing people for rate hikes basically all year. So they're making a sudden change in their Fed policy, which is kind of alarming because it makes people in the stock market wonder, well, was something wrong, or maybe the economy is not as good as they claim, which it probably isn't. So that's one reason for the stock market to drop like it has recently. But in the end, the real problem, though, is that there really is nothing they can do if the market continues to decline. And last night, to show you where we are, which is pretty amazing, on CNBC, they have their head economics reporter, his name's Steve Weissman. He basically gets leaks from the Federal Reserve and reports them on television. That's his reporting. Him and there's a couple people in the Wall Street Journal who kind of do the same thing. But anyway, after the stock market fell quite a bit, he said that the Federal Reserve is not going to raise rates in September. And then he said that they are going to do, this is the word he used, which is kind of ironic from what you're saying about Rand Paul. The quote he said is effective easing. He said that the Federal Reserve is engaged in effective easing by doing nothing. Like if they don't raise rates, that's as good as easing. which is, in other words, if there's nothing they can do, and that by doing nothing, that's going to help the stock market, which is pretty amazing. So this is a situation I don't think most people really understand that the Fed's kind of trapped like that and trapped the stock market. But I believe that if the market continues lower, which I think it will, that this will become the real driver of lower stock prices and the realization of this reality.
Yeah. Well, now, yeah, I know that I've seen Peter Schiff from time to time. I don't follow him that closely, really, but I've seen from time to time on TV basically screaming and yelling over the past couple of years that they can't stop quantitative easing. They can't raise interest rates ever. Everything is on such a bubble now. I mean, as much as the bad bets are still kind of being canceled out from the last time, there's still all this deflation going on. That whatever does seem like prosperity at all is all just bubbles. And that if they quit with the quantitative easing, then, well, he said, we see the collapse of the fuel prices, and then housing and bonds and this, that, and the other thing are all next too, unless they go back to inflating again. And like you're saying, maybe now that ain't even good enough, but the music's playing, so I gotta stop and try to come up with a question in the next 4 minutes. We'll be back with Mike Swanson from Wall Street Window right after this.
Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com.
You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.
All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Mike Swanson from WallStreetWindow.com about the Dow, the big stock market collapse. And so if I got you right, what you're saying is that they can keep inflating, but at this point it's not working. It's time for a bear market, and they're not going to be able to prop it up by just, you know, expanding bank credit at this point. So, but they're going to keep trying, right? It's not like they're going to go ahead and shrug and allow a recession to take hold. Although I wonder if they just quit inflating and let markets clear, how long would that really take if they just let capitalism work for a minute? Let the bankrupt go bankrupt and let prices find where they belong, you know?
Well, I mean, I wish they would have done that 10 years ago or 15 years ago.
Yeah.
And we probably wouldn't be, you know, talking about this kind of thing at all. We'd be living in a real economic boom that's sustainable and a time of prosperity. In fact, if you look after World War One in the early 1920s, the Fed did exactly that. And there was a very bad, you know, recession. But it was short-lived. I think it was like 6 months or 8 months. And, you know, then, of course, you had the 1920s, but people forget about that, you know, and want the Fed to fix things for them, or they've come to believe they have to. And I don't know. It could be that maybe they do have to do, you know, try to keep – maybe we can't face that type of situation because of the size of the national debt. But, I mean, I don't know. If that's the case, they certainly seem to be scared of something. And one thing that's interesting to do, there's a book called Greenspan's Bubbles by a fellow named William Fleckenstein, and it's based on Fed transcripts in the 1990s. And if you read that, and then also you can get the transcripts of the meeting from 2008, I think it's, if you read in between the lines, it does seem like they're frightened of something. I don't really know what it is, and it's not ever really fully articulated, but it seems as if they're afraid if the system could just collapse for good or something. But, I mean, I'm not saying that's the case. I don't believe that is the case in the sense that, you know, the economy is going to disappear, people are going to stop doing things or something. But, you know, I mean, if we had to go on the gold standard or not be able to run limitless deficits, it would certainly mean a different society and a different type of government. We wouldn't be able to engage in endless wars, that's for sure.
Well, and this is the joke, right? This is the argument for the Fed, is that we have to have people who are elected to these basically appointed to these basically indefinite terms at this separate central bank, because if Congress was in charge, which is supposedly the only other alternative you're allowed to consider, well, and they would have only their short-term selfish political interests at heart, and they would always do nothing but inflate, and they would never allow a correction. Whereas at the Fed, they're independent so that they can go ahead and weather the criticism and take away the punch bowl at the party so people don't get too plastered. And then that's exactly what they do not do ever.
Yeah, the only time that has happened is under Paul Volcker and after World War II and in the early 1920s, as I mentioned before. Those are the only three times that I know of in history where the Fed really did take away the punch bowl, and both times, you know, you had prosperity afterwards. The problem is that by bailing things out, they, you know, if they hadn't bailed, I think of 1998 because that's when I started doing this stuff and following it. And that's when there was that long-term capital crisis linked to the default in Russia. And that would have been a recession there, but Greenspan lowered rates, and you had the internet bubble, and then, you know, that blew up. You bailed that out, cutting rates. You got the real estate bubble, and you get 2008, and now, you know, they lowered rates to zero and did quantitative easing. And now we have this new bubble, which I think is in the stock market, which is pretty, I think is over. But there's also a bond bubble, which I don't think has popped. I think it is probably topped out, but it may take a year or two for that to even start to really decline because, at first, at least, falling stock prices make some people buy bonds as a safe haven. So that should help bonds out. But that's the real potentially dangerous true bubble, you know, that would really hurt the economy, is if the bond market goes into bear market and Fed, you know, really can't do anything but print money to keep those prices up, which would really be a disaster. So that's an argument that they really can't do this forever, and they're just trapped in the sense. All they really can do is just hope that things somehow work out. And really, they haven't yet. I mean, the economy has not been able to grow at a sustainable rate. And I think they were hoping maybe that we had reached that point and that they could raise rates and return to a normal, more normal situation. Because, I mean, the real problem the best example that there is a problem is that interest rates are zero, and just the mere talk of raising them to a point slowly over what would be a year, which is what they were suggesting, they can't even do that. I mean, the people in the financial media have actually, some of them have blamed the idea of the Fed raising rates as the cause of the market dropping down. They're basically screaming for them not to do it, and announced they won't do it. That's a horrible summary of where we are. I mean, that's what the Federal Reserve has achieved all these years of quantitative easing and the zero rate policies. They just created a stock market bubble in this dangerous situation, and there's no real economic growth in most parts of the United States. I mean, there is around Washington, D.C., but not where I live. I think not in most cities and places. Maybe there is where you live in Texas, but not here.
Well, now, so if the bad stock market is driving people into bonds, and you're saying that the bond market is in a bubble, I don't know what percentage of the of investors really understand that or what have you, but if the stock market keeps doing worse, and that keeps propping up the bond market, but then so the question is, where else do they have to go but the bond market? When it comes to that kind of thing, will that, in other words, will that be successful? Will the crisis in the stock market really help the bond market, or it'll just put off the inevitable and make it that much worse?
Well, that's the big unknown. I don't, you know, when I look at the stock, the financial markets, I'm basically, you know, we talk about, you know, try to figure out what's going on or the background of it, like we're talking, but I really look at charts and use what they call technical analysis, which is basically looking at trends on charts to figure out what's going on in the market. But that only really works looking about 6 months out. It's really not useful to try. It doesn't really do well for figuring out what's going to go on down years down the road. So it's really, you know, I really don't know what things will look like a year from now. But I think there are alternatives. They don't look attractive to people now, and the main alternative would be gold and silver and precious metals, and which I do own positions in those things, but they haven't done well so far this year, and they've been in a bear market since 2011, so not many people are interested in it, but I own positions in them because I do think, you know, eventually they're going to go into a real bull market. And if the bond market situation unravels in a couple of years, they would be the things that would go up and benefit. So I actually think, you know, just about anyone that has investments or whatever should have, you know, some sort of position in gold and silver, like 10% or something, just to protect themselves from that type of thing. But I think, you know, if the stock market declines, it goes into a bear market, I don't really think it'll hurt the real economy that much, because it's just really a small segment of people in the stock market now. A lot of people got out in the last bear market, and it's really not as so many people are dependent on it as they were before. And a lot of people got out because they needed the money, you know, because of the recession, the poor economy, and, you know, younger people don't have hardly anything in the stock market. So I think the more potential danger is this bond situation if that happens, but I can't, you know, point to any evidence that it is. I just know it's a potential problem that could happen. And if it does, it probably would happen after the stock market has a big decline.
Yep. All right, well, we're out of time, but thanks very much for yours. Good to talk to you again, Mike.
Yeah, good talking with you, too.
All right, y'all, that's Mike Swanson at WallStreetWindow.com.
Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first, and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world, except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org, or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon.
Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Jacob Hornberger, tireless champion of liberty and president of the FFF, brings you the best libertarian writers every month on the topics that need our treatment the most. Read Jacob, Jim Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Joe Stromberg, and more every month in The Future of Freedom. It's just $25 a year for the pocket-sized print edition, $15 to read it online. The Future of Freedom, fff.org/subscribe.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. And I'm stalling for time because I'm trying to pull up Reese Ehrlich's Amazon page so I can tell you about all the things that he wrote. Inside Syria, the backstory of their civil war and what the world can expect. Conversations with terrorists, Middle East leaders on politics, violence, and empire. The Iran Agenda, the real story of U.S. policy and the Middle East crisis. Target Iraq, what the news media didn't tell you. Dateline Havana, are you catching on here? Yeah, he does good journalism, man. Here he is at the Global Post and at USA Today. Iran's Jewish community gets behind nuclear deal with U.S. Welcome back to the show, Reese. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Very happy to have you back on the show, and very interesting read here. Don't get too much journalism by Americans out of Iran, so tell us all about it. What do you know?
Well, I was there roughly 2 weeks ago. I was able to stay for 10 days, which is unusual because they usually limit foreign reporters to 7 days. I got to, among other things, talk with leaders and ordinary people in the Jewish community, most of whom support the nuclear deal with the U.S., and oppose Netanyahu's stand on that issue. And apparently that got some folks' knickers in a twist. And there's been some controversy ever since.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I did read your companion piece here at Global Post. And I hope USA Today ran this too, or some version of it or something.
Well, the LA Daily News ran it. I haven't seen anything in USA Today yet.
All right. So, yeah, but here at the Global Post, it's right-wing American bloggers have a problem with facts about Iran's Jews, and I wasn't sure if you even wanted to dignify these idiots with their ridiculous criticisms, but it does, you know what, it's an opportunity to explain, you know, actually the truth wherever, you know, they pretend that there's something to accuse, so go ahead.
Well, basically, the criticism is that the Jews of Iran are so oppressed, you can't possibly get an idea of what they really believe because they would be afraid to talking to an American reporter. So that casts doubt on my central thesis that most Jews there support the Accord. Well, it's just stupid logic. It's just people who've never actually been reporters have never been on the ground. Yes, Iran is a very repressive place for Muslims, Christians, and Jews. Yes, there's lots of repression, but people will also speak honestly to reporters, particularly since Ahmadinejad was voted out of office and the new president is in. There's a more moderate atmosphere. And, you know, I did a good job of talking to over 24 Muslims and Jews in my reporting and got a pretty good feel for how people were thinking. I went to poor neighborhoods and rich neighborhoods and a Jewish hospital and a Jewish kosher restaurant. So I stand by my reporting.
Well, and so when you talk to these people, I mean, I don't know what the hell. I've never been to Iran. Is it a absolute totalitarian North Korean nightmare where they really are terrified to say what they mean to each other, to you?
No, it's not. And I've been in countries where it's that kind of totalitarian atmosphere. And basically, people won't talk to foreign reporters at all. I must have gotten at least a dozen person in the street type interviews while I was there. And I do this on every trip, by the way. I've been reporting there since 2001. There are red lines, that is, people will talk to you, but you don't criticize Ali Khamenei, for example, the supreme leader. You always, if you disagree with him, you say it's his advisors who are giving him bad advice. But you definitely don't criticize the supreme leader. So it's not like there's freedom of speech or freedom to organize. Certainly, we saw in 2009 how the government brutally repressed people protesting the what they saw as fraudulent elections. But when it comes to the economy, to the accord, it's signed in Vienna and a whole bunch of other issues, people speak freely.
Which is believable enough as long as you actually want to know the truth about the situation rather than just you have a right-wing agenda and you're sticking to it. Which is a
That's a different kind
of category of thought here.
Yeah, I mean,
you know?
There's a sector of the right wing in this country that would never, doesn't want any deal with Iran under any circumstances. And then you work backwards from there. So if you don't want to deal, you can't trust them. Therefore, anything that indicates you might be able to trust them is ignored.
Yeah. All right. Well, so tell us more about the Jews of Iran, or at least the ones that you met.
Well, it's a small community. There's somewhere between 8,000 and 30,000. Estimates vary, depending on who you talk to and what figures you use. It's the second largest Jewish community in the Middle East after Israel. It's way down. There were over somewhere around 100,000 in 1979 at the time of the revolution. Most left. Many came to Los Angeles and other parts of the U.S. and to Europe. But those who stayed are allowed to practice their religion, as are the Christians, by the way. There's no guards in front of the Jewish temples. They have six functioning temples in Tehran and six kosher restaurants. There's Hebrew schools. When it comes to the practice of their religion, they're free to do so. And politically, they're subject to all the same restraints that all Iranians are. But that's a whole different question.
Mm-hmm. Well, and they have representation in the parliament, correct?
Yes. Yeah, it goes back to even before 1979. There's a tradition of having Christian, Armenian, and Jewish representatives in the Majlis, or in the parliament. And that continues. It's a way to get kind of affirmative action, if you will. It's a way that they think they're protecting the rights of minorities. Now, the problem, of course, is that the Majlis is a body that is severely constrained. The clerics control who gets to run for it. There are elections, but who you get to choose is severely restrained. So it's not really democratic. Mm-hmm. But within the confines of the Islamic system in Iran, Jews do receive parliamentary representation.
And now when you talk to the people that you talk to, did any of them say that, listen, you know, you're dealing with evil here, man. You can't. You have to. Netanyahu is right. We should have full-scale economic or maybe even real war until regime change, because it's just intolerable, the system that these people are forced to live under. Reese, nobody said that to you?
Nope. Somehow that topic never came up. I have over the years. Remember,
you know what? Let me interject one thing here to try to play devil's advocate a little bit. I'm sorry to interrupt,
sure.
But you know, I remember seeing. It was a documentary about the city of BAM, I think, something like that. Anyway, and there were people who said, yeah, when Bush comes, yeah, things would be great once Bush comes or something. And that was kind of a figure of speech there for a while, that there's going to be a regime change and maybe things will look brighter after that. Is that just total nonsense?
Well, I'm sure there are people in Iran, and indeed I've met some. Not, they weren't Jewish, but they were Muslim. But, yeah, the argument went something like, if the U.S. comes in, it bombs Iran and takes out the leadership, that will be good for the people of Iran, and they'll be able to have a democratic government without the clerics. That I did hear that argument. Not a lot, but there have been some. The problem, of course, is that the U.S. can't replace the government in Iran by bombing alone. We've seen that now in Iraq and Syria and Afghanistan. You have to have troops on the ground. And if the U.S. tries to occupy Iran, let alone try to bomb it, it's going to cause a huge nationalist upsurge. The people of Iran ain't going to go for it. And no matter how much they hate their current government, they will rally around it to support them against an outside invasion.
So in other words, it's as plausible as the Occupy movement calling for French airstrikes against George Bush, because then everything will be great once the foreigners help us get rid of the Republicans.
Right. And then the French occupy Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
It ain't going to work.
Sounds about right. All right. So what were you going to say before I interrupted you?
Well, I was just saying that the, it makes perfect sense if you're Iranian to support the deal, because it will hopefully lift sanctions, which are hurting the economy. It will lessen the chance of your country being attacked. And neither Jews nor Muslims are interested in having their capital or their country bombed by Israel or the United States. Now, there are opponents of the agreement, for sure, and I interviewed some, and they tend to be ultra-conservatives. It's like the mirror image of the conservatives in the U.S. Senate.
Yeah.
They think the deal is a sellout of Iran's national interests.
All right, hold it right there, Reese.
It's like everything the right wing says here flipped on its back. So the U.S. is going to use the inspectors to insert spy devices.
Wait, hold it. Right back with Reese Ehrlich in just a sec, y'all.
Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our status enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org.
Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Roberts & Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co.
All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Reese Ehrlich. He was recently running around Tehran asking people what they think of the nuclear deal, including went to a restaurant where Jews like to hang out and asked them what they thought. They were all for it. They don't want to be bombed. Can you believe that? They're very selfish, you know, looking out for not being exploded. No, I'm just kidding. So, Reese, you're saying the only people who you found, are you really being serious? The only people you found, no exceptions, the only people you found who opposed the deal were people who were right-wing hawks in Iran.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. There's no, nothing that parallels the U.S. objections, the conservatives here. The people who, and I went to Friday prayers, I went to restaurants, I just stopped people at random on the street, I went to student outside the university, so I really went to a wide variety of different places. And the conservative argument in Iran is that the U.S. will, as hornswoggled Iran, they've gotten too much. You know, it's not mentioned here, but it's true that Iran is giving up so much uranium enrichment that they won't even have enough uranium to power their one existing nuclear reactor. They're going to have to import nuclear fuel from Russia or somewhere just to keep their current reactor running. And that's considered a sellout by the conservatives in Iran.
Which it is, but, you know, hey, what are you going to do when you're up against Hitler? But, hey, try to appease him. I mean, it's not like you can field an army in Czechoslovakia, right? Why are you going to guarantee the freedom of Czechoslovakia? So, yeah. No, I mean, so, that's their position that they're in. They have to appease us. And you know, I've been seeing all this propaganda. Oh, the Iranians, they're dancing in the streets. Like, to a man, all the civilian population of Iran, they're all just a bunch of devils out to get us. And the fact that they're celebrating can only mean one thing: our impending doom. And it's not at all. It couldn't be that, hey, maybe now the crippling sanctions will be lifted. And trade will be legalized again. Wouldn't that be nice if we didn't have to starve to death or, you know, watch our loved ones die of easily treatable diseases because we can't import any medicine?
Yeah, and, you know, we get a lot of propaganda in the U.S. about the sanctions, that they're targeted against the mullahs and the Revolutionary Guard, and they're don't affect medicine or food. That's just hokum. I went to pharmacies. I went to hospitals. And until fairly recently, they couldn't import medicines because the U.S. sanctions basically blocked all banking transfers. So they had the money, but they couldn't get it to the Europeans, for example.
And you went to the hospitals and the pharmacies yourself and talked to these people.
Oh, absolutely. And this was 2 years ago in 2013 when it was the most intense. Mm-hmm. The good news is that that's eased up in the last year, year and a half. As the talks began in earnest, the U.S. basically told the banks, it's okay, you don't have to keep prohibiting all transfers of money, and the medical crisis eased somewhat. There were still problems with students stuck abroad. Imagine if you're studying in Germany, for example, and your parents can't send you any money. How are you supposed to survive? You're a student, you know, on a student visa. And that happened to thousands of Iranian students stuck in various countries around the world. They had to go to various illegal means to get money simply to survive. So the sanctions hurt ordinary Iranians much more than it hurt the elite, who actually make a lot of money off of the corrupt dealings to get around the sanctions. Mm.
Well, and you know what? That's a very important point that I wish you'd elaborate. Could you talk a bit about the Revolutionary Guards and the oil black markets and that kind of thing?
Sure. Well, the Revolutionary Guards, which of course were the military operations set up after 1979 because they couldn't trust the regular army, they fund themselves by setting up various companies, mineral extraction companies, oil in some cases. They control all the seaports and the airports. I might note as a sideline that once the Revolutionary Guard took over the airports, the quality of the smuggled wine got much better in Iran because they were interested in making money, and they increased the varietals and the availability. Uh-huh. So they're heavily involved in smuggling. So it's a very corrupt system. The people of Iran know it and they resent it. And however, because of the sanctions, the Iranian government was able to point to the U.S., the British, and others and say, look, the problem is not with us, your leaders. The problem is with these outside foreigners who are imposing these sanctions on you. And of course, that argument had some validity, and they were able to, as one economist pointed out to me, they were able to fog the situation up. They were able to make it seem like somebody else was at fault. Whereas when the sanctions are lifted, it will actually make it clearer that the problems in Iran, if to the extent they continue, are because of government policies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is just the same as always, right? That's always the Ayatollah's line, is that anybody who opposes them is CIA, or at least that's kind of the implication. Student protesters in the street, we know who's paying your bills, the NED.
It's not the implication, it's the direct charge.
Yeah.
You know, if you're on
and we make it plausible,
media criticizing the government, you must be a CIA agent.
Yeah, and sometimes it's true and sometimes it's not. So
that's
they
right.
have
that's
that
what,
going
that
for them.
That does make things more complicated.
Yeah, yeah. We intervene just enough to discredit the opposition to these guys. And we put sanctions enough on to destroy their competition and leave the entire oil mafia to the IRGC instead of anybody else in the country.
Yep.
All right, so now, I mean, that explains why they would be attacking the deal from the right in Iran for their own selfish interests. But it looks like, I guess, if the Ayatollah's on board, then we're just waiting on the Congress. Otherwise, you know, the Iranian, yeah, there's nobody in Iran could stop it now, right? On their end.
That's, well, not quite. It's the most likely scenario is that the Supreme Leader, who has not yet taken a stand on this, will come out in favor of it once the U.S. Resolves the issue and supports it. However, if the somehow the conservatives in the Senate, for example, get enough votes and in the House to override a presidential veto, then all hell breaks loose and the Supreme Leader will also come out against it and denounce the U.S. and we're back to potential war and all the previous problems.
Well,
but
do you
that
think
does not seem to be likely at this time.
At that point, though, if the deal breaks down, all the worst case scenario, do you think at that point they would withdraw from the non-proliferation treaty, or they would just keep their hands up and say, look, the whole world knows that we have a safeguards agreement anyway, and that all this Parchin and PMD is nonsense anyway, and so, fine, the old deal was good enough anyway, or are they going to go ahead and withdraw from the NPT and all that?
I don't think they would withdraw from the NPT right away, because that would be counterproductive. If the U.S. rejects it, that makes the U.S. the problem. And they're going to go to the Europeans, the Russians, and the Chinese and say, look, we signed the deal that you all agreed to. Let's you guys lift the sanctions. And the whole sanctions regime becomes unilateral by the United States. And everybody else starts trading to one degree or another with Iran. So it will have the opposite impact of what conservatives in the U.S. charge. I think what the Iranians would do regarding the nuclear program is that, you know, there's something called the additional protocol.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you're familiar with that, but basically it was something that Iran agreed to extra inspections beyond what's required of all members of the NPT.
Right.
That they would probably withdraw from. They would keep the current
You know
level.
What? I'm sorry. I'm losing your audio a little bit there. I got
can
most
hear me
of
now?
That, but yeah.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah. Yeah. Go ahead.
All right. Yeah. They would, continue the level of enrichment. They keep all their centrifuges running. They keep their research facilities. Everything that the U.S. has managed to negotiate for them to give up, they would keep while not having any sanctions against them or not having any meaningful sanctions.
Right.
So,
but I'm sorry,
yeah,
on the additional protocol, you're saying they would not adopt it or they would go ahead probably and stay with that?
Yeah. See, in fact, they haven't adopted it yet. It's pending. Right. The approval of the Congress and
on the other hand, they could adopt the additional protocol without any of the rest of this deal. I mean, I don't guess that they would at this point.
They could, but it requires that's the things about the snap inspections and all that
right.
they have a lot of problems with.
Right.
And they're willing to go along with it as part of a wider deal. But if the U.S. pulls out, why allow that?
Right. Yeah. I mean, the reason they were under it before was because they were under the impression, at least they were pretending, they were believing that they were negotiating with the E3 in good faith back in 2003 through 5. And then when it was clear that Bush had instructed the Europeans were not allowed to get anywhere on this, the Iranians went ahead and withdrew from the additional protocol, which they'd never ratified in the first place. So
that's exactly right. And remember, the Iranians had made a deal with Brazil and was it Russia? They had Brazil, Turkey. And Iran that would have solved this issue years ago.
Yeah, in early 2010.
It was denounced by Hillary Clinton
and the
Obama administration.
Yeah. Yeah. And in fact, at least the way Ray McGovern tells that is that, well, I think it's official that Obama asked them to do it. But when they came out with the, hey, we did it. We came up with the nuclear swap. And it wasn't this all-encompassing kind of deal, but it was a good swap deal to get rid of the 20%, a good start, that kind of deal. And as soon as they did that, Hillary denounced it. And the way Ray tells it, at least he believes that she sandbagged the president on it and you know, laughed it out of court before he even got a chance to, you know, say, actually, I asked them to do that, and I appreciate it. And so by the time it was his turn, he could only go along with her on that or something. Although, I don't know.
I'm not sure of that version.
Because he did ask them to do it. And
absolutely.
They did it, and he went ahead and left them twisting in the wind.
Yeah, the president of Brazil released the formal letter that he had received from Obama. So there's no question that the U.S. had asked them to do it.
Yeah.
I think they had a change in policy. I think they thought they could get away with doing more, and
they did.
They sandbagged Brazil and Turkey.
Right. And it worked out for them overall, I guess, in the long term, because they did get a lot more concessions than just that nuclear swap in the end. But
yeah.
All right. Well, listen, man. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No. I was just going to say I like your theme music, man. It sounds like Super Scott.
Oh, cool. Yeah. You know what that was? I think the one you're thinking of was the Spaceballs theme song.
Yeah, oh, is that what it was? It sounded like Superman or something.
Yeah, yeah, Spaceballs. It's a little bit of a play on that. But yeah, man. So hey, I'm sorry we're over time and I gotta let you go. But thanks again for doing the show. I appreciate it, Reese. Good talking to you.
Always a pleasure.
All right, y'all. That is Reese Ehrlich. He's at USA Today. That's good news, man. Regularly writing there and at globalpost.com. We'll be right back in a sec.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
This part of the Scott Horton Show is sponsored by audible.com. And right now, if you go to audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, you can get your first audiobook for free. Of course, I'm recommending Michael Swanson's book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. Maybe you've already bought The War State in paperback, but you just can't find the time to read it. Well, now you can listen while you're out marching around. Get the free audiobook of The War State by Michael Swanson, produced by Listen and Think Audio, at audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show.
All right, y'all, welcome back. I should do a poll. Hey, chat room guys, how horribly annoying is it when I go out to break in the middle of talking with the guest and just do it like that? Because a lot of times what happens, the music comes on, and I'm like, oh, man, I ain't done with this yet. And I turn down the music in here and for the guest, and we just go on into the break. And I know it must sound terrible, right? But how terrible? Tolerable or intolerable? It's an important question. But, man, I hate the hard breaks. They kill me, man. If only I had soft breaks, you know? Oh, well. Anyway, hey, I'm Scott Horton, so it's my show. And I'm sorry that I haven't done enough opposing of Donald Trump. I mean, I guess I just figured that he opposes himself. Everything he says, the guy's a total freaking ridiculous maniac. He's a ridiculous maniac. And somebody asked him something, I don't remember what it was, and he says, it was an interview I read with the Hollywood Reporter, some crap, some ridiculous thing. And they ask him something, and he goes, oh, you know what, I can't remember. It doesn't matter what it was, I can't remember what it was. But he goes, you know, I can't remember. And I have one of the all-time great memories. But on that particular thing, I can't think of it. You know, like really? Out of 7 billion of us, you got one of the all-time great memories. Not just, hey, I got a pretty good memory. But one of the all-time great memories. I just love that. I think it's great. And every time the guy opens his mouth, I laugh my ass off. Like the Rick Perry stunt. He was going to get away with that. Hey, look, everybody, I got hipster glasses. So now you'll think I like reading things. And Donald Trump just goes, he only bought those glasses so you'll think he's smart. Oh, man. Undone. And, yeah, so, you know, I have to say, I know people who laugh their ass off about George Bush all the time. George W. Bush would say something. My buddy Chad, I remember, he would just be laughing his ass off at George W. Bush. And I'd just be sitting there seething with rage. George W. Bush, you know, Fred Flintstone cursing. And Chad would go, dude, come on, it's hilarious, man. And I could see the stupidity in it, but it just didn't tickle my funny bone, you know. But with Trump, man, the guy's funny as hell, dude. He's so funny. One of the all-time great memories. Anyway, I mean, that's the stupidest thing, but you know, there's a million of them. Everything he says about everybody, it's completely ridiculous. And it's the most fun I've had, you know, watching political stuff at all. I read articles about what he says, and I'm literally laughing out loud, which I don't often do, you know, but this freaking guy. And it was funny because, the comparison's been made often to Benito Mussolini, but somebody posted a YouTube of Benito Mussolini and the speech that he gave where he's up there and he's going, I mean, I don't know exactly the translation, but basically you could put Trump's words in his mouth. Oh, yeah, no, I know exactly what to do. I'm so smart. I'm so big. I'm so tough. I'm the big leader. I'm the leader of you. I'm going to tell you what to do. I'm going to make everything great because I know what to do. We're going to manage it just right because I'm the boss. I'm El Duce. Like, that's it. That is it. It's perfect. And the fact that Americans love him so much. I mean, man, it's a pretty big deal, the Trump movement. People just love a demagogue, man. They don't want freedom. And that goes for the left as well as the right. We can talk about Bernie next. But they don't want freedom. They want a powerful guy to tell them what to do. To tell you what to do. You know? And they're terrified of whatever, you name it, make up a new one. Doesn't matter. Something to be terrified of. How about the guy with the mask from Scream? I'd be terrified of that for a minute. Tell him it's a black guy under there. Anyway, they love it. Do you hear at one of these Trump rallies, I think it was in Alabama or in Arkansas, somebody's shouting out, white power! Oh, my God. Hey, nobody quote me out of context there. God dang it. I'll be really mad. Somebody yelled that out. I shouldn't impersonate. I should just say, did you hear that someone yelled out that phrase? That way nobody can splice me. Don't splice me. See, now I'm giving people ideas. Just shut up. But, yeah, so that's the Trump turnout. And then what's funny is, the sober, reasonable, moderate, centrist, rhino alternative to him is Jeb Bush, who can't help but be the worst Bush we ever had as president for at least 4 or maybe even 8 years. And that's the whole thing about Trump is a freaking clown, but you look at who his competition is, they're all freaking clowns. You know, you're right to say that this guy is a ridiculous person. He's not a serious candidate. But what makes him any less serious than any of these other guys? That's not to stick up for him. That's to agree with you about him. But look at his competition. It's almost as though the entire Republican Party is as illegitimate as Donald Trump. And speaking of illegitimacy, Bernie Sanders. Dude, here's the thing about socialism, man. If the producer and the consumer are the same guy, then he doesn't know how much to charge himself for the thing that he did. Price system breaks down. Goods and services get rationed instead of bought and sold on the market, and people starve to death. Okay? And okay, all right. I mean, it's not, you're right. That's not fair. He's not calling for total state ownership of everything, but still. He wants to, basically tax and regulate everything to death. Free college for everyone. Why would anyone go to work again? You can just sit around and learn how to weave baskets all day. I mean, there are some people who are going to work anyway, but there are a lot of people who aren't. I mean, and there's a million of them. And who's going to pay for it all? You get a $17 trillion national debt. And, anyway, socialism doesn't work. And you know what? Fascism doesn't work. Fascism, the middle of the road, leads to socialism. And so that's why, you can look forward in the near term. I mean, it's just a saying, but it's a good rule of thumb. Because the middle of the road, meaning, regulation and control of industry and whatever, that just drives up prices. And then that makes people complain and demand solutions to their high prices. And then you get more and more regulation until finally the government just takes ownership of it. So when Obamacare is fully implemented and it has a few years to do its work on its distortions of the market and people's prices and taxes and the rest, and it gets to a point of severe crisis, then we'll hear more calls for single-payer national government, Medicare for all. Go ahead and completely socialize it. And look, it makes sense, man. People, no, not that makes sense, but it makes sense why people believe it. People are hurting, you know? It's just like in that first interview there with Mike Swanson. The economy sucks. It has sucked. I remember the 90s during that bubble thinking, you know, a lot of people are still really hurting. And that maybe there's a big bubble on the NASDAQ and a big bubble on the stock market and in some of these sectors. But if this is prosperity, America's got some real problems here, man. And then the fake recovery, that was the recovery from the first Gulf War. Then the fake recovery from the collapse of the Clinton years during Bush Jr., the height of that bubble in housing and the rest of it, it benefited some. But we could all tell real wages aren't going up for regular people. The only reason anybody's feeling any richer at all is because of the bubble in their house. If they own a house, it's becoming more valuable. Maybe they can refinance and use it like an ATM. No real growth then. And now another era of this. Another crash. Another big hollow fake prosperity that benefits the few at the very top at the expense of everybody else.
Hey y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts.
All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton, and it's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Tonight, me and Jeff Tucker do an Eye on the Empire. Did you know that the Empire laid their hands on Jeff Tucker and locked him in a cage like an animal the other day? Jeff Tucker. They better not got his suit dirty. Anyway, so we're going to be talking with him about that, and we're going to be talking with him about Joseph Schumpeter, Austrian school economist of yesteryear, and his great book about imperialism that Jeff recently reread and has a lot of things to say about it. And then also, I'm going to help cover the wars for you. Well, you know, America's at war in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, Libya, Syria, Iraq again, and of course Ukraine. And so there's always plenty to talk about, and the police state here and this and that. So tonight at 8 Eastern, 7 Texas time, liberty.me. Just click the blue button that says live on it, and you'll find Eye on the Empire with me and Jeff Tucker, 8 o'clock tonight, Eastern. All right, cool. And then, you know, tomorrow, there's about a 99% chance, so I'll go ahead and say, tomorrow I'm going to interview Sheldon Richmond about this article that he wrote, Libertarian Class Analysis. I was reminded of this. I've read it before, but I was reminded of, and I think Anthony wrote a really good thing along these lines, too, at FFF as well. But anyway, so this one is by Sheldon, and I was reading over at Lou Rockwell's blog. There's a guy there, a historian by the name of Charles Burris, who does really great stuff, or always writes really interesting things, and has apparently read about 100 million books before or something. Sometimes he does these, what do you call a man where it's not quite a bibliography because it's an essay too? A bibliographical essay, that's what it is. He does those. Bibliographical essays going, well, this and this book are about this aspect, and this book are about that aspect, and it's all full of the links to the resources and where. Yeah, you know, he's a historian, like I was saying. And he linked to this article by Sheldon Richmond. And Sheldon Richmond starts out the article just like you would want him to say. Hey, if somebody says class war, class conflict, or something like that, then you think they're a communist. And I could see why people would want to have nothing to do with that, so they run the other way. But wait. Libertarians, actually, or classical liberals, as they were called back then, invented class analysis, not communists. Individualists did. And it's not a topic to shy away from. It's actually at the heart of what the state is all about, man. Regulatory capture writ large. Get it? Yeah, dude. See? You do get it. Good, good, good. See? Sheldon Richmond. 99% chance just came 100%. Became 100%. Sure, 9:30 Pacific time is good, he says. Okay, good. Libertarian class analysis. So we're going to learn all about that. How the communists are right in a sense that the very richest people are your enemy, but they're wrong that they're your enemy because they're rich. They're your enemy because they use the state to steal and oppress their competition. And that is virtually all of them, but no, not all of them. Of course not. There's the, well, I'm going to ruin it for you. There's the economic means and the political means of making a living in this world. Some would rather steal, and that does go for businessmen too, of course. So, all right, that'll be tomorrow, so that's cool. And then you know what, man? I need to get somebody on about the refugees. There's a huge refugee crisis, and of course, it's all America's fault and our allies, a sock puppet, NATO allies, UK and France, for their war in Libya. And you know what? Gaddafi was a bad guy, but you know what? You didn't have boat people like this under Muammar Gaddafi. And by the way, America made a deal with him. Bush made a deal with him. And then Obama stabbed him in the back. What the hell kind of diplomacy is that? And anyway, there are people drowning to death. There are helpless little kids drowning in the Mediterranean, trying to get to Greece, trying to get to Italy. And, well, it's all because of the wars. Syrians, too, of course. And, yeah, I don't know. Who would have thought that actions had consequences? Certainly no mathematicians I've ever heard of. All right, well. Before I run out of time, there's a few other things I want to get to here. This is important. Nadler. What a great name. Gerald Nadler is a congressman, a Democratic congressman. And he says that his vote against the Iraq War caused some to question his commitment to Israel. And apparently, according to Mondo Weiss here, according to the New York Times, he is the lone Jewish member of Congress from New York to back the contested arms control agreement. And a friend, a well-connected friend, says expect a 2016 Democratic primary with his vote front and center. Nadler has Borough Park, Brooklyn in his district, the heaviest concentration of Jews anywhere in the U.S. Well, of course, all he has to do is tell the truth. You ought to be able to win them over, that this deal's good for Israel, never mind what ridiculous Netanyahu says. They elected him over and over again anyway. But here's the point that I'm really trying to get to. Is he says that, hey man, you know, back then when I stood up against George W. Bush on the Iraq War, I got criticized for not being pro-Israel enough for that. Well, huh? That's funny, because we're not supposed to understand that the Israel lobby or the neoconservatives and their pro-Israel motives, or the Ariel Sharon government, their motives and interests, the Likud party. Actually, you know, Sharon was still in Likud sharing that with Netanyahu, but Netanyahu was at least as big or more of a champion of regime change in Iraq than even Sharon was. But anyway, we're just not supposed to talk about that at all. The reason we did the Iraq War is because Saddam tried to kill George Bush's dad, and maybe, I don't know, something about oil, but couldn't say what. And yeah, nah, it's to a great degree, it was about Israel. And so anyway, this is just another little thing at the time. I took a lot of criticism for my vote, says Nadler. Both my American patriotism and my commitment to Israel were questioned. Made it even more difficult was the fact that 9/11 attacks happened in my district. And while history has proven my decision to have been the right one, the demagoguery is an unfortunate stain on that period. People were calling him a traitor, an American congressman. He's a traitor to Israel for not supporting the Iraq War. You know, the closest the mainstream media ever really got to addressing that was, believe it or not, Tim Russert interviewing Richard Pearl once said, now Richard Pearl, you and your buddies David Wurmser and Douglas Feith and a couple others, you wrote this paper back in 1996 saying that it'd be good to get rid of Saddam Hussein for, it'd be good for Israel if America would get rid of Saddam Hussein. And so what do you have to say about that? And he's, well, I don't know, nothing. So you can assure the people that your support for war against Iraq now has nothing to do with your support of Israel or its strategic positions? Yeah, that's right. Has nothing to do with it, Tim. Okay, I'm satisfied, said Tim Russert. I'm surprised he even bothered to ask the question in the first place, really. But yeah, you can read it yourself. A clean break, a new strategy for securing the realm. The road to Damascus runs through Baghdad. Which makes no sense. Yeah, we're going to weaken Iran by getting rid of Saddam Hussein and importing the Iranian Revolution, bringing it, you know, 600 miles west. Why? How? Big dummies. But anyway. And then this is funny, too. Eli Clifton found this. This is at loblog.com. AIPAC 2001 to 2004 briefing book. Made case for regime change in Iraq. Oh, yeah, no, we had no position on it. Wrong. And now I ran out of time to talk about all my insane police state stories for today. But so you'll just have to tune in tomorrow. Oh, yeah, they're going to be scanning and memorizing your heartbeat. That's your new biometric scan. How do you like that? Born free.